You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 19th of January 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24. Coming to you from Studio One here at Midori House with me, Emma Nelson and Gillian DeBias.
Coming up on today's programme, we'll be exploring two global festivals here in London. Critic Donald Hutero will be doing his best to translate a silent art form into radio, the London International Mime Festival.
And also kicking off today is The Rest Is Noise, a classical music festival running all year here in London, which attempts to chart the history of the 20th century through music.
And staying with music of a different kind, we'll be crossing to New York for our weekly review. Today's guest is producer and founder of the Tummy Touch record label.
And as ever, we'll give you a dose of global culture for the coming days, with a special focus on Sao Paulo.
Even though Carnival doesn't start until the second week of February, preparations are on its way, and Paulistanos are already enjoying the pre-party.
So lots to look forward to this week on The Review here on Monocle 24.
Indeed, but first, Gillian, how's your cultural week been this week?
Busy. Busy seeing Mime, but also I did sneak off because it was so cold and snowy, so I snuck off to the cinema yesterday to see Life of Pi.
You've also seen Les Miserables, which we ripped pieces a couple of weeks ago on air, I must confess. But you came back with a completely different point of view.
Well, yeah. I mean, it depends. I love musicals. And so I had been expecting to hate this version for some reason, just all the clips I'd seen. And I just thought, I'm going to hate it. But I do love to see every film nominated for all the BAFTAs and all the Oscars. So I snuck away to a matinee and I found myself sobbing and singing along. And I was quite pleased I was on my own. Because
I think many other people would be quite pleased you're on your own as well.
I parted my cynicism, actually. I found surprise. I did part my cynicism and I really loved it. But I have seen the musical probably five times live on stage, so
I think some of the critics have said that it hasn't translated well from the theatre to the cinema. But you said it's
a different way. I think it's very different. I mean, the stage musical, you love the production and the voices, but this, they use the camera angles and the cinematography, I think, really well to create a completely different Les Mis. And that surprised me.
How lovely.
What about you?
And you also saw The Life of Pi.
Yes, Life of Pi in 3D glasses. And although I felt mixed about it because I adored the book, I just absolutely adored the writing of the book. But the opening sequence of the zoo in 3D is magic, I thought.
That is something to look forward to. I had a mime experience this week, because we will be talking about mime in a little in just a few moments. The critic Donald Hutera is standing by to talk to us about it. I saw Jung Fai, an hour-long puppet show at the Pit at the Barbican.
We will save that.
We'll be talking more about that in just a moment. In the meantime, you're listening to The Review. It is indeed perhaps an unlikely medium to discuss on radio. Mime. While popular culture perhaps regards the art form with somewhat of a smirk, the mime world itself is thriving. The London International Mime Festival is now in its 37th year, and it promotes visual theatre in all its forms and with tremendous success.
Exploring everything from psychedelic puppetry to aerial acrobatics, the festival has become an international hub for talents. And to talk us through these performances of ideas, Donald Hutera, dance and theatre critic for The Times, joins us now in studio. Hello, Donald.
Hello. Can I just say something about the Mime Festival and about how mime gets slagged off? It's because of all that white-faced whimsy. But all of that, all of those cliches and stereotypes, I think that the two people who are the co-directors are so good at subverting that and at pointing out just how much innovation and how much diversity there is around the world in visual and physical theater.
So where did we get stuck with the stripy T-shirt whimsy?
Well, Marcel Marceau.
And it never got further than that.
Well, no, it has.
Indeed.
But it's gotten much further. And the Mime Festival embraces what they call object theater, a lot of circus. It's not all that twee stuff. And I'm not trying to negate what, you know, the path that Marcel Marceau took. But it's gone in a lot of different directions. And And basically what they do is little or no text, although sometimes there are words in the shows, but it is the physical visual, or visual, which is my kind of cute, pretentious way. Take your pick.
It's a portmanteau I think I might not be using again, but thank you very much for introducing it to us, Donald.
I was surprised because when I first clocked the Mime Festival, I did literally think it was going to be silent actors on stage. And, you know, this is circus and it is puppetry. And I think one of the unifying things, I suppose, it is expression from all countries around the world. Who's participating?
Now, some of these things are ending tonight, so there's, and they might already be sold out, but there's many world-class artists. I did a post-show talk with Anton Adasinski of Derivo, in a piece called Harlequin. Right, Russian, based in Germany. He's the real deal. Mm-hmm. He's an absolute artiste, and I don't mean that in any kind of negative way against him. Yeah. No, He's so dedicated. It is a life and death matter when he gets on stage. And he's a master clown. And he's in this show, which is sort of like a Russian clown theater version of When a Man Loves a Woman, with his offstage partner, although I don't know that they want that to be known, Lena Yar, I can't remember, whatever her last name is, the woman that he's with is this rather cruel coquette. And he's a very heart on his sleeve, or actually heart in a cage, which she winds up eating his heart, which is a red pepper. But it's very visual,
very
physical.
Dark,
it's very dark,
cruel,
but it's
almost.
It's charming, though, too. And he's such an artist, and I'm so glad. This is the fifth time that company has been in the Mime Festival. So what the Mime Festival does is build relationships with companies. And another is Compagnie 111 from... France. Aurélien Bory is the artistic director, and it's a show called Plan B, which I didn't see this time. I saw it when it was first on 10 years ago. It's acrobatics with brains and feeling, and it's at the South Bank. And unfortunately, I don't have a chance to see it again because I'm going to Blind Summit, who are the puppet theater makers who worked with Anthony Mangella on Madame Butterfly. And they're doing a new show called Heads, or else it's called The Heads. I'm seeing it this afternoon.
Before we start having a look at the individual productions that Gillian and I have been to see a couple, and obviously you've seen most of, if not all of them, where are the great cultural centres for mime at the moment? If you are a budding mime artist, where do you travel to? You mentioned France. That's the key place to go, isn't it?
I think it's a key place because there are people like Camille Boitel and Mathurin Bolza and James Thierry, who's Charlie Chaplin's grandson, although he wants to downplay that. And they're all based in France. I think France is definitely a place to keep an eye on.
One thing that I was trying to find, though, when I was doing a little bit of homework on this, is that in the centre of London, is there, and this could be a question to be asked of any major city around the world, why doesn't there seem to be a one venue that everybody gravitates to in which to explore mime? It seems to be a sort of a mishmash of different art forms that everybody puts underneath the roof of mime. You mentioned physical theatre, puppetry.
Circus as well.
Do you think that mime, the word, doesn't actually do the art form enough justice? And if no, where do you go and find this stuff?
Well, it doesn't do it enough justice, but they don't want to change the name of it because it's a brand name by now. And I don't think they need to. And I think that multiplicity of styles is actually a very good thing. And what's very interesting about how mime fits within the UK scene is there's such a lot of different kinds of theater, and so much of it moves into physical areas that the boundaries blur. But I think that boundary blurring is not a bad thing at all. I think that's to be commended, and it shows how rich this endangered culture of ours is.
When I went to Rackham's Razor, I was struck by these incredibly young, vibrant performers, and I was trying to work out where they came from, what motivated them. I thought they all must be maybe gymnasts, and once their career's over, they just fall back into circus. But it was the other way around, is that these incredible physical performers who've had studied all sorts of things, from philosophy to history, and then they've decided to channel themselves through these schools of theater, of physical performance. And, you know, it's really a vocation and it's a choice. And it's interesting that the younger generation are choosing this, I thought.
And what's interesting about that to me, too, is that no knowledge is wasted. So whatever they've used in their background, and fine arts, singing, et cetera, can be filtered into the
work
that they do.
There's an intelligence, isn't there?
Absolutely. And the work and the show that Occam's Razor is doing is called Not Until We Are Lost. It's purpose-built sets, purpose-built equipment, and a live choir with a live harpist. And the audience is free to move around. It's a promenade performance. And I found it quite magical.
Me too.
A friend who called it anodyne. It wasn't edgy enough. But there's something about isolation and community that's being explored in a very, all right, easy-to-like way. But what's wrong with easy-to-like when it's at a very high level of craft, which is what they do?
There's often a need when you don't have words to construct a narrative. It's absolutely key to hold an audience's attention. How do they construct the narrative here?
Well, it's episodic. So there are maybe four or five different vignettes. So you've got five people on some,
a climbing frame that turns into a swing.
And it swings. And you're watching them lift, pull, slide down. And
all on the theme of getting lost and being found.
And there's a tentativeness about what they're doing, which is about how do we connect with each other. And so on a really, really basic level, the audience gets that. We don't need words because we understand how they're behaving towards each other. It's body language.
Their performances were great. It wasn't just the physical awe and wonder, because it is extraordinary what they're like acrobats. But they're really focused on the acting as well. So I think, you know, people, I was looking at the audience and their mouths were open and they were really drawn into these characters more than what you'd just expect of the shock and awe of something like the Cirque du Soleil.
It's the same thing that I feel about, people in ballet or in any other dance form. Sometimes they say, oh, we're not actors. But because you're dealing with emotion and expression, you have to have a sensitivity to that kind of thing that ideally, if you're clear about your intentions, even if your intentions are sort of ambiguous, it can be understood and read in different ways by whoever's watching it and experiencing it.
And how important is the idea of scale in these performances? Because in a moment we'll move on to a very intimate performance that was on at the Barbican earlier on this week. But you mentioned the idea of people moving around on great frames. Do you think that often either distances you from what's going on, or does it actually become an impressive part of what's going on?
Well, in this case, you're allowed absolutely close to that frame. There's also a tower that's transparent that they climb inside, and you can sit
and it's a very
as
small
close
venue.
As we are right now in the studio and watch them behind that Perspex wall doing what they do. So that scale's a very good point about the Mime Festival, because there are very close-up, personal-ish shows, but there's also spectacular pieces like Zimmerman and de Perrault, who are Swiss, and they'll be at the Barbican next week with a show called Hans Was Harry, H-E-I-R-I. I have no idea what's going to happen, but they are large-scale thinkers, so there will be some sort of big set that will play with perspective and scale. So it'll be a different experience. It'll be a larger, for want of a better word, more spectacular experience.
Let's move on to it was Jung Fei Han's stories. It was playing in The Pit, which is a tiny little theatre underneath the Barbican, a great venue, one of my favourite venues in London, because it's visceral. You can smell your actors. It's great fun. This was a story of a Chinese puppeteer, the fifth generation of Chinese puppeteers. And it was set out very clearly at the beginning that he was the end of a generation. There would be no more of the likes of him. And there were some charming elements of telling a little bit of his father's story, not just using puppets, but in using some footage of his father as a puppeteer. It was a very intimate, personal story of one man's connection with his family. What did you think of it, Donald?
Well, I don't think that it went deep enough or mysteriously enough or truthfully enough into what it's about, because there is a fascinating story. I loved the one image that we had, a bit of film footage of him and his father doing puppetry together. But, you know, you said up close smelling. I didn't smell the puppets, really.
You smelled the incense, though.
Yes,
they were very consciously trying to create an atmosphere of another place for
and
you.
And I appreciate that attempt, but I didn't feel very engaged with it, and I wanted to be closer to it. He is a master puppeteer, but I just didn't feel the connection as much. And what put me off was midway through, there is an angel who, for whatever reason, starts talking and singing Queen songs in English.
It ruins it, actually. It's a ghastly moment in the performance.
And it goes on for about 5 or 10 minutes, and it was hard to recover. But there's some very, very nice... but the political subtext of that show is very interesting, and I actually wish it had been more explicit, because there's a lot about what's gone on in China over five generations that would be fascinating to dig into, and I don't think that he did that.
No, I would absolutely agree with you, but I wonder whether it was the actual format that let the whole story down, because the puppets that we were watching, I mean, at one point I was thinking, is this really, this has got nothing to do with mime, this is a puppet show. The puppets that we were dealing with were very small. They were about a foot long, you know, it's 30 centimetres long. And despite the fact that the scene was very, that the theatre itself was very intimate, you did feel a very, very long way away from what was going on. And yes, I thought it worked figuratively insofar as the puppet of the puppeteer's father, who is the one who is physically broken by the communist regime. Mm-hmm. And we see him trying to lift stones and then dying because of the effect that this regime has had on him, because he's had his puppeteering taken away. I thought that was nice, because you had genuinely had a little man being broken. But apart from that, I did feel somewhat as if it was too long. It didn't really, as you say, get to the heart of what this man's story was all about.
There was some essence that was missing, and I don't know, I can't quite put my finger on it, but it didn't feed me as I maybe wanted to be fed.
No. That ends tonight, Yung Fei, the pit.
But we love you, Yung Fei.
We love you. We love you. Thank you very much for coming over from France, where, you know, he now lives in Hong Kong, doesn't he? Because he had to flee China. The London International Mime Festival goes on until the 27th of January here in London. As you can probably gather, there is pretty much something for everybody, and it is not just all men with white faces and stripy T-shirts.
Can I recommend one show?
Please do. Mm-hmm.
There's a guy named Romeu Runa, who's from Portugal, and I think it's a two-hander. I've not seen it. It's by the company Les Ballets de la Baie, from Belgium. Sorry, I'm getting my international countries mixed up. And he did a nude solo as a stag in an art gallery in September that I saw, and he was staggering. I have to say that. But he's such a wonderful performer that I'm really excited about that. It's on just for 3 nights next week at the Linbury. And that would be one of my kind of tips.
Why didn't I get tickets for that? Why did I cop the tiny Chinese
puppet?
Even
though the festival comes to an end, these are productions you can see all over the world. So regardless of whether the festival ends this week, people should be following these troops, and they can see them in their home countries. Or, you know, mime does travel around the world.
Donald Hutera, the dance and theatre critic for The Times. Thank you very much indeed for coming into the studio. Stay with us on The Review next, because next, Nelly Gocheva will take us through the world's cultural highlights for this weekend.
For 1 week every January, the world's bankers and financiers, its presidents and finance ministers, its titans of industry, union leaders and economists all head to Davos, picturesque town on the banks of a beautiful lake and in the shadow of the snow-capped peaks of the Swiss Alps. And this year, Monocle 24 will be there too, broadcasting live from the World Economic Forum. Next Wednesday and Thursday, The Briefing and Midori House will both come live from Davos. Join us as we keep an eye and an ear on the world economy.
You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Gillian Tobias, and Emma Nelson. Time to cross to our associate editor, Nelly Gocheva, to hear some cultural treats she's dug up from around the world for us this weekend.
This weekend marks the closing of the 25th edition of London Art Fair, featuring over 130 contemporary art galleries from the UK and abroad. Additional to the main fair programme is the Photo 50 exhibit, a selection of 50 photos curated by art critic and founder of London-based Paradise Row Gallery, Nick Hackworth. The London Art Fair is at the Business Design Centre in Islington. For more details, go to londonartfair.co.uk. This weekend, Oslo is hosting Norwegian Icons, an exclusive show celebrating Norwegian design, co-curated by auction house Blomqvist and coffee shop Fuglen, the exhibit focuses on mid-century designs by the likes of Hans Brathwaite, Gerhard Berg, and Birger Dahl. Now in its second week, the show is free to attend. Norwegian Icons is on until the 11th of February, and after Oslo, it will travel to Tokyo and New York later in the year. Back in London, longtime analog aficionados Lomography are staging an exhibition in their Gallery Store East in Spitalfields. 25 UK-based artists, designers and illustrators have been selected to customize the brand's iconic La Sardina DIY camera. The result? A colorful range of one-off pieces from some of Britain's most creative Lomography lovers. The exhibition is on until the 4th of February. Now in its 22nd year, Photo LA is back this week with dealers, collectors and curators from across the globe gathering in Santa Monica to exhibit works both old and new. Art gatherings and galleries to look out for include the US-based International Cinematographers Guild and the Czech Center of Photography. There will also be a number of lectures and roundtables on offer, including today's discussion with the curators of the two Robert Mapplethorpe photo exhibitions at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art and the J. Paul Getty Museum, respectively. For more details, visit photola.com. And finally, the South Carolina musician Chaswick Bundick, better known as Toroi Moi, hits Europe this weekend for a string of shows, starting in Bucharest today and continuing to Dublin, London, Paris, Amsterdam and Berlin later in the week. The dates are in support of his new album, Anything in Return, released this Monday. Dates in US and South America follow in February. For more details, go to toroimoi.com. And now, let's hear Kola. For Monocle, I'm Nelly Gocheva.
And that was Kola by Toroi Moi, ending that report there by Nelly Gocheva. As Nelly said, he's on tour right now in Europe and his new album is out on Monday. It is Nelly Gocheva's birthday today.
And staying on the topic of both birthdays and music, it's time now for our weekly music review. And today we're crossing to New York, where on the line we are joined by Tim Lee, whose birthday it is also.
Yay!
Many happy returns, Tim. Tim, I think we'd better introduce you. Tim Lee started his career playing Hammond organ for the 1980s pop stars and is now a DJ, producer and regular radio host and founder of the Tummy Touch record label. Welcome to Monocle 24, Tim. What are your cultural highlights at the moment in New York?
Well, the cultural highlight I'm looking forward to most today is my first coffee.
Thank you for waking up so early for us.
Which unfortunately I haven't had a chance to have. But tonight my good friend Michael Allen is having an auction. Michael's been having he was involved in two car accidents in quick succession, so he's having to raise money for medical bills, which is something that we do over here. So he's auctioning off a bunch of his incredible drawings. So I'm looking forward to seeing Michael's show tonight.
Tell us, we mentioned there that you're from Tummy Touch. Tell us a little bit more about it.
Tummy Touch actually started life as a club night, as a party in a tiny nightclub in the middle of the all-night fruit and veg market in Nottingham in the early 90s. And the label kind of grew out of wanting to find an output for the music that, you know, I was playing at the club. And really, you know, starting from pretty scrappy beginnings, you know, over the course of 20 years now, you know, we've started to get quite good at what we do, and we've branched into all sorts of other things now. We do music publishing, we do a lot of catalog management, we do some artist management and consultancy and stuff like that.
I was reading somewhere a description of Tummy Touch, and they explained the music you pull together as bohemian, disco rock, sci-fi, electro soul, unruly Latin mashups, and oddball urban exotica. Is that fair to say?
That is exactly what we do, yes.
And so explain some of the things that you find in this musical world of yours that match that that description.
It's a tough thing to explain. Even after all these years, you know, we still find that music just comes to us. You know, we've always got our ears open, but there's no sort of fixed route to finding the sort of thing that we're after. As you can imagine, you know, it's always a bit different from the thing before. So, you know, we tend not to go to the same place to get the next thing. It's really just a matter of like having our ears open and being open-minded and you know, waiting to see what comes into our path.
Tim, let's talk about one of these tracks that you've selected for us today. It's a track called Too High from a band called Graham. Tell us a bit more about it.
Graham, I actually used to live with a member of the band many years ago in Nottingham, and he would have come to the original Tummy Touch parties when they were in a band that was signed to Acid Jazz called Emperor's New Clothes. Graham, you know, brought out one EP about 15 years ago that got everybody super, super excited. They were the first people to kind of have another look at the sort of New York, no wave, post-punk thing. You know, did it their own way. They did this one EP that got everybody super excited, and then they completely disappeared. Nobody heard a thing out of them until last year. The band started releasing, you know, limited edition vinyl of new material, first new material in something like 12 years. So it was terribly exciting to find out that they were still up to it and just doing fantastic music. So, and I've heard the album now, and it's really, you know, worth 12 year wait.
Let's have a listen to their track Too High. And that was Graham there, a London group making stripped-down lo-fi disco. Their track was called Too High, and it was the choice of Tim Lee from Tummy Touch record label, our guest music reviewer. Tim, where would you hear that kind of music now? What kind of nights are devoted to that kind of music?
That particular track has had a couple of remixes and is being heard a lot of places. I'm just turned 43 today, so as you can imagine, I don't spend too much time in nightclubs anymore. But those guys, you know, they're also doing it live. I saw them in London last year, and the live show is really fantastic. So, you know, hopefully they will be playing in a rock venue near you soon.
Let's move on to your second choice. This is Joni Hastrup and Greetings. Why have you chosen that piece of music for us?
Joni, actually what it was I was listening to your show a few weeks ago, and you had Quinton Scott from Strut Records on, and it reminded me of a story. We used to share an office with Strut, and when they were working on their first Nigeria 70 compilation, and every musician that Quinton had spoken to says, oh, you've got to find Joni Hastrup, you know, he's really key to the whole Lagos, you know, early 70s scene. You've got to find him, you've got to talk to him. And he couldn't find this guy, couldn't find him at all. For a year and a half, tracking him down, finally found him, and they used the song that you're about to play on the compilation. But the whole time, you know, Joni is actually my brother-in-law. friend, you know, and I would see him, you know, a few times a year, and I had his phone number and everything. I just had no idea it was the same person.
What was it like when you did realise what was happening?
Well, we were all delighted. because obviously, you know, I mean, unfortunately, you know, in typical fashion, so many of the musicians had never been paid for any of their work. So, you know, here was the opportunity finally to get a bit of recognition, but, you know, also to make a bit of money.
Let's hear it.
And in fact, sorry, in fact, we Johnny's solo album was reissued, and the albums from his band that he was in called Mono Mono are available again for the first time since, you know, the early 70s.
Well, let's hear a little bit about this. This is Johnny Hastrup and Greetings. And that was Greetings by Johnny Hastrup, the brother-in-law of today's musical guest, Tim Lee, from Tummy Touch Records. That's an amazing piece of music, Tim, because it brings together so many different genres. How did you never know that he was one of your relatives?
It's just one of those things, you know. I mean, he was a teacher. You know, I sort of knew him as that. I was sort of unaware of this sort of storied history. And he toured with Ginger Baker and all kinds of stuff. There's a wonderful video of Ginger Baker in Africa in the early 70s that features Johnny heavily. But somehow, you know, those stories have passed me by. I don't know.
So you were going back and looking through family albums and seeing these great pictures of his past.
Unfortunately, yeah, he doesn't have them. So, yeah, I've not seen them.
It does bring a whole new meaning to the idea of the family album, doesn't it? Let's move on to your final track, Tim. We'll say goodbye to you before we hear it. So it's Patrick Dawes. Tell us a little bit more about him.
Patrick, another character from, you know, early clubbing days. First came across Patrick. He used to play bongos in nightclubs along with Groove Armada. When Groove Armada were just a DJ team, you know, before they started making music, that's the first time I met Patrick. And then he played on all of their albums and toured with them for years. He's played with Richie Havens. He's actually, you know, a really fantastically talented percussion player. And he's done two solo albums. This, I believe, is a track from the new solo album. Of sort of really quite sort of startlingly different music that he does on his own.
The percussionist and DJ was a particular feature of the early 1990s club scene, wasn't it? Do you think it still exists? And what actual benefit did it ever offer to the evening? I mean, it was lovely to look at, but one sometimes did wonder if the percussionist was there for his own pleasure and very few and for no one else's.
That's a very good question. And yes, you know, it's not something I've seen for a while either. But Patrick was one of the rare ones that actually knew, you know, when to play, when to not play. Like I say, you know, he's a world-class percussion player, and I guess, you know, the real secret to that is figuring out when to shut up.
Tim, I'm afraid time has run out on us for today. That was Tim Lee, DJ, producer and founder of the Tummy Touch record label. Thank you so much, Tim, for joining us on today's review. Let's hear your final track from this from Patrick Dawes. Patrick Dawes there, and that track was Funambule. That was the choice of Tim Lee, the A&R maverick behind Tummy Touch Records, our music reviewer on today's review.
There's much more music ahead on the show. Next up, time for classical music. But first, we're going to cross over to São Paulo to hear what's coming up over the coming days. Our resident Brazilian, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, fresh off a flight from the city, is here to guide us through his city.
If you are in São Paulo this weekend, there are plenty of cultural happenings for you to enjoy. As the weekend might be a bit rainy, a good option is to see the newly released Brazilian film Som ao Redor, Neighboring Sounds, about a paranoid middle-class neighborhood where everybody worries about everything, from robbers to loud dogs. The New York Times already selected the film, directed by Kleber Mendonça Filho, as one of the best of the year. If you're wondering which cinema to go to, make sure you walk along Avenida Paulista. It has one of the highest concentrations of independent cinemas in Brazil.
Funky, tinha muito preto e branco. Barroco baile funk, porque tinha muita festa. Barroco baile funk.
Even though Carnival doesn't start until the second week of February, preparations are on its way, and Paulistanos are already enjoying the pre-party. On Saturday night, Concert Hall HSBC Brazil will host the Festa Tropicália, a night with Carnival group Bangala Fumenga and DJs Rodrigo Lunaredelli and Emiliano Beirucci. For a cultural Sunday afternoon, why not go to MIS, the Museum of Image and Sound, which is currently playing host to an exhibition about the history and importance of music videos. It contains a wall full of parody videos and the clothes Brazilian band Pato Fu were wearing in their Made in Japan video, one of the most expensive Brazilian music videos ever made. A visit to underground art gallery Choque Cultural might also be a good option. This weekend, it will open the exhibition The Blind Society by French artist Benjamin Janjan and Brazilian artist Snort. The gallery is one of the places to go in São Paulo if you're looking for alternative art. To end the weekend, make sure you grab a summery cocktail, or even better, go and grab a snack in the city's famous 24-hour bakeries. For Monaco, I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
And you're with a review here on Monocle 24. After the break, we'll ask how you reflect the history of the 20th century through music. Stay tuned.
On Monocle's culture show, we want to be like the fabled Hydra, one of the great monsters of Greek myth, but in a good way. Listen to one fascinating story and two more eagerly pop up to replace it. So it's only scary if you're frightened of the following sorts of things. Reports from all over the world on art, books, magazines, media, music, film, publishing, advertising, and photography. Or if you're terrified of beautifully performed intimate live music sessions from some of our favourite acts recorded in our performance space right here at Midori House. It's Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. It premieres on Mondays at 1900 London time, and frankly, it's the heroic Hercules that defeats the evil Hydra of radio boredom. Join us and enjoy the legend.
Welcome back. It's Saturday, and you are listening to The Review with me, Gillian Tobias, and Emma Nelson. We move now to contemporary classical music, a genre that these days battles to find a wide audience. It's astonishing to think that barely 100 years ago, premieres of some pieces caused riots in the street.
A year-long festival, however, here in London aims to introduce the 20th century in a musical form. Based on the book by the critic Alex Ross, The Rest is Noise will explore the way the events of the last 100 years have shaped our music. It's an ambitious idea. Well, to tell us more, I'm delighted to say we're joined in the studio by Tim Walker, Chief Executive and Artistic Director of the London Philharmonic Orchestra, one of the key partners in this year's festival, and Richard Burness, a conductor and music consultant to the likes of Tate Modern. Welcome, gentlemen. Tim, to start off with you, you've taken time out of the rehearsal to come and join us today. Thank you very much. How are you kicking off this year?
Well, we start tonight with the Rest is Noise Festival, and obviously, as it's a history of the development of music in the 20th century, we're starting with just the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th, with an all-Strauss programme.
which you have to do. And we'll hear the beginning, the famous opening of Strauss's Also sprach Zarathustra in just a moment. How do you go about constructing a century of music?
Well, in this case, it wasn't difficult because Alex Ross did the hard part. His book came out in 2007. Jude Kelly, the artistic director of the South Bank Centre, immediately picked up on it. In fact, before it was actually published, and said to Alex, this would make a great basis for a festival. And she then discussed it with me, and I said, yes, we'll buy into that. All 32 concerts of the OPO at Royal Festival Hall will be devoted to an exploration of the history of music in the 20th century, starting with Strauss, ending with John Adams, El Niño, composed in 2000. And we had a lot of fun putting it together, some good discussions with Alex Ross. As always, it's what you leave out that is the problem, because there's so much that you could do. But this festival is 250 events, so it's not just the OPO. Sure, we're doing the big orchestral stuff, but there are visiting orchestras also contributing from around the country and overseas. And then there are talks, chamber music, recitals. There's a wealth of interest for anyone in this festival.
What really impresses me, Tim, is that there seems to be a lot of deep background available online at the Open University.
Yes.
So that all of the weekends where you're showcasing things and interrogating them by performance are further elaborated, and you get a lot of interesting research, and the sidelines are filled in that way. And I think that that's really an exceptionally intelligent way of handling such a huge subject.
Well, what I was interested in, a lot of festivals are based around composers or certain pieces of work. You know, as the soundtrack of the 20th century, it really is like a very much a social history. And I was fascinated to see the small one-minute video on the South Bank Web Show, which accompanied music to photographs and real newsreel footage. And it made it so powerful. And I'm wondering if this is a really smart way of engaging people to really connect with the music because of the times and what it says about that century.
Nowadays, visual arts culture and museum culture is much more about interrogating the work. You look at the painting or the sculpture or the installation, and you look at the materials, you see what the artist had in mind, and then you judge whether that has been fulfilled within your own terms. You have a more equal relationship, a kind of discussion with the work of art. For far too long in concert programming, I think we've been encouraged to be passive receptors, just to accept what's performed. And what's great about this festival, I hope, is that it will encourage people to interrogate the pieces and not just accept them.
Tim.
Yes, I think the whole notion of trying to understand why music developed in the 20th century in the way it did, relating it to social, political, economic, rise of nationalism, Hollywood, all of the influences, and to understand what influenced what is tremendously exciting. It's very deep, I agree with you, and we've got wonderful partners in Open University, BBC, also Guardian and so on, coming in to amplify this.
Let's have a listen to the first piece of music. We too had a very hard time trying to whittle down the whole of the 20th century to four pieces of music. We'll start off with 1896, the tail end of the 19th century. This is the opening of Strauss's Also sprach Zarathustra. And that, of course, was the opening of the tone poem by Strauss, Also sprach Zarathustra. An amazing piece of music for actually bringing space travel into the popular culture. But also, when you think about what Strauss was like as an individual, his journey through the first part of the 20th century was pretty much... It sort of sums up the difficulty in which the individual had in terms of dealing with a social and a very volatile political situation.
It's interesting. I was very impressed with what Alex Ross said about Strauss in the book, because he really paints the young Strauss as a radical, as an explorer, as an inquirer, who then became more and more conservative and actually realized himself at the end, after the Second World War. And in the late 40s, he felt that he himself was a dinosaur. And that trajectory is very interesting, but it's great to have the emphasis on the young Strauss and those pieces that are genuinely groundbreaking. And it's brilliant to start both the festival and the book with Strauss's Salome.
Mm, absolutely, because although we now think of him as being, in a sense, a late romantic composer, it was shocking when Salome came out. And it was part of what led then to Stravinsky, the writer. I mean, everything is developmental. And so Strauss is also a pivotal composer.
And when you think of Strauss as the individual and the fact that he, near the end of his career, he was obviously tied up in Nazi Germany. The thing that always strikes me about music in the 20th century is not just the composers, but the musicians involved in the production of the music. And the Second World War is a terrifying time for musicians, especially because many of them working in Austria and Germany, and you see thousands and thousands of... You see basically a lot of the musical world being decimated by the Nazi era. So it has it's a sort of big changing point, isn't it, in terms of the way that people have to approach their music in the century.
Well, actually, the OPO was part of this. During the Blitz of London, Queen's Hall was decimated with all of our instruments in it. I mean, orchestras and musicians, our very own, were part of this history in a very direct way. I mean, the OPO was the first orchestra into Russia after Stalin. We were the first orchestra to go into communist China after the Cultural Revolution. We are in ourselves a part of that history.
I mean, it's interesting. We have the Manet exhibition about to open, and it's sort of known that the Impressionist paintings really were, you know, had to struggle to get their contemporary art sort of accepted at the times. It's similar with musicians like Strauss and Salome. How really volatile was the reaction to something like Salome when it first came out?
I think there was a tradition, Gillian, that certainly in the before World War One, if you didn't have a premiere that was greeted with a riot, you hadn't actually made much of an impact. You know, there just had to be that kind of explosion, not just in the orchestra, but in the audience as well. And Salome had a very, very rocky reception when it was first played in Dresden. I think it was in 1905, 1906. Mm. But then not too long after that, there was a very famous performance in Graz, in Austria, where Puccini and Schoenberg and half of the Viennese nobility came to hear the piece and received it as if, you know, okay, we don't understand this, but we know it's important.
Another piece of music, which you mentioned riots just then, which caused a riot when it was, well, I think it's a fabled riot in 1913 when it was premiered in Paris, which was Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. Let's hear a little bit about it. Part of The Rite of Spring by Stravinsky, premiered in 1913. We're joined in the studio by Tim Walker, the Artistic Director and Chief Executive of the London Philharmonic, and Richard Burness, the Conductor and Music Consultant. Tim, describe the sort of multifaceted approach that they took to the Rite of Spring, the fact that the likes of Picasso was involved. This was a cross-cultural endeavour, and it caused a riot. What kind of piece of music nowadays could cause such a reaction? Or is that, are we no longer in that era anymore?
We are in that era, but we're too polite. So the most you'll get is somebody yelling out after a world premiere, thank God for that, or you get some boos, or, you know, you'll get a reaction, but you won't get a riot, which I think is rather disappointing. I think that, I mean, some people speculate that maybe the riot was Diaghilev's idea of getting publicity for the piece.
Well,
anyway,
it worked.
I mean, he was a genius, let's face it, at all of this. It did work.
Yeah, but I think it made it French page news the next day.
Yes.
There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
I ages ago at the Almeida Festival, I did the first UK performance of John Adams' Grand Pianola Music, which is a big parody of uber patriotism at the end. It's very, very beautiful, cool, still, minimalist music that then evolves into a a large marching band. And I turned around to accept somewhat stunned applause, and I realized all the critics looked as if they'd been hit over the head with a wet fish. And that is as close as you'll get to a riot in,
looking like
in,
a wet fish.
In Britain nowadays. But they'll look discomforted, but that's about it. Yeah.
I was, you know, when we look at this piece, it's Nijinsky, it's Cocteau, it's Picasso. I mean, incredible heady names of the time. Now, currently, is there a group of kind of contemporary classical music composers who are working with, you know, the heady artists and writers of,
yes,
of our time?
I think so, definitely.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's such a close bond just in, I guess, the senior generation now, people like Steve Reich and Phil Glass, who are so closely associated with Donald Judd, with Sol LeWitt, with the major minimalist visual artists, as well as, you know, their own composition practice. And that's a very, very strong bond. There's almost a whole repertoire associated with a particular gallery in Chelsea called the Paula Cooper Gallery, which I tend to call the Paula Cooper Songbook. you know, I mean, there's that's very strong, and it's probably happening now, and we don't know about it.
Let's hear a little bit of Steve Reich. This is from his, there's a four-part piece called Drumming. This is Drumming Part 4. That was Drumming Part 4 by Steve Reich. It's an amazing piece of music because it starts up layers and layers and layers and layers and layers of percussion, doesn't it? Tim, why do you think pieces like that need to be included in festivals like The Rest Is Noise?
Because actually the public loves Steve Reich.
They do.
I mean, he's so accessible, yeah.
And he's visually incredibly engaging, as all the
other
pieces.
Yeah,
voice
about time. He speaks to people very directly. I mean, most of the music actually that the London Philharmonic plays now is 20th century music. It's not. It's you know, it's part of our culture. It's part of us. It's why we commission a lot of new work into the future, because it's that will be the music that the people want to hear in another 20 or 30 years. Maybe they're a bit behind music being written now, but they'll catch up.
Who is this festival aimed at?
I think it's aimed at people who haven't come to the concert hall, but who like the idea of a context for everything and who want to follow the journey. I mean, if you came to these 250 events, what a fantastic thing to be able to devote a year to really understanding 20th century through music. Fantastic opportunity.
And just finally asking you, what is your thought of it? What do you hope to get out of this year's festival? What do you hope to have learned by the end of it?
I think it's the spirit of inquiry. It's not feeling shy about encountering things that you may not know. And it's also realizing that we now have these tools. I mean, also in Alec Ross's blog, you can find playlists, deep research, things like that. I think there's a Alex Ross list on Spotify even nowadays. So, you know, there's no excuse for not cluing into these things.
Richard Burns, conductor and music consultant, and Tim Walker, artistic director and chief executive of the London Philharmonic Orchestra. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. That brings us to the end of the Saturday Review. Our thanks to our producer, Katie Bulbo, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Chris Fitch.